Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Malankyaputta Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches Malankyaputta what questions are fit to answer and what questions are distractions from the goal of the Dhamma. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on October the 18th, 2016. This talk concludes with Metta Intentional Meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
The Malankyaputta Sutta, also known as the Malankyavada Sutta. This is another sutta where the Buddha is questioned regarding the great questions that humanity has been seeking answers for since the beginning of time. The Buddha consistently refused to answer anything that would prove to be a diversion from the goal of the Eightfold Path or would only reinforce ignorance. As Buddhism developed, many of the accommodations made to the Buddha's teachings were done to provide answers to these questions and others like them. When looked at closely and in the context of the Four Noble Truths, many of these questions have an underlying motive of establishing a permanent self in the physical realm or a non-physical realm. In other words, most of these questions have to do with where do I come from and where am I going to go? This is the sutta itself. The Buddha was at Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. One of the monks of the Sangha, Malankyaputta, was in seclusion when the thought occurred to him. The Buddha does not give an answer when asked certain questions. He doesn't answer when he's asked, is the cosmos eternal or not eternal? Is the cosmos finite or infinite? Does a body have a soul or not? Does an awakened person exist after death, or do they not exist after death? Or do they both exist and not exist, or neither of these? This is kind of confusing, isn't it? One of the great later teachers, Nagarjuna, built everything that he taught on that one question, is there existence or is there not existence or is there both? And, you know, I've read some of his writings, and I used to think that it was useful to me. Many people have found it useful. And the more I got into it, the more confusing and discursive that thinking was. And it wasn't until I read suttas like this where I realized that there's no answer to it, and the answers are really just another distraction. Malankyaputta continues to himself, I don't accept that the Buddha refuses to answer these questions. I will seek him out and ask him about this. If his answer satisfies me, then I will continue as his disciple. If he refuses to answer me, I will leave the Sangha. That evening, Malankyaputta went to the Buddha, and upon greeting the Buddha with a bow, sat to one side. Great teacher, I have been pondering why you do not provide a satisfying answer to these questions. Is the cosmos eternal or not eternal? Is the cosmos finite or infinite? Does the body have a soul or not? Does an awakened person exist after death, or do they not exist after death? Or do they both exist and not exist, or neither of these? So that question itself is rooted in the common belief of the time that grew out of the Vedas, which paints a picture of somehow of a vast nothingness that has the potential for everything to exist, and yet at the same time it's empty of anything. Very confusing. And the Buddha studied these teachings, and he came to an understanding that they weren't helpful in developing his understanding of suffering and how to bring cessation to suffering. If you can answer these questions, great teacher, based on your knowing, which he's putting the Buddha right to the wall. He's saying, if you really know, based on your knowing, I will remain a disciple. If you cannot answer these questions from not knowing, I will then leave the Sangha. The Buddha's response, Malankyaputta, did I ever tell you or even imply that my teaching would answer these questions or that these questions even deserve an answer? No, great teacher. Well then, why are you claiming a grievance or making a demand of me? If you threaten to leave the Sangha unless these questions are answered by me, then you should leave the Sangha. You are like a man who has been wounded by a poisonous arrow. His friends brought him to a surgeon, but he refuses to have the arrow removed until he knows who shot the arrow, their position, their physical attributes, and even what type of bow they used. They further delay the action that will save them by insisting on knowing what type of animal the arrow feathers are from, and the type of wood it is composed of. All of these questions have nothing to do with the matter at hand. They will die never knowing the answers to these foolish questions, which only prove to be a distraction from what is most important. So obviously what was most important is to get the arrow out. To Malankyaputta, what's most important is to develop a clear and direct Dhamma. Whatever your view is of these questions, the right view is, it's up on the wall, the right view is, dukkha occurs, craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha, cessation of this process is possible, and the Eightfold Path is the path developing cessation. Everything the Buddha teaches comes right back to that, comes back to the Four Noble Truths. I do not answer these questions as they are not fundamental to the goal. They do not develop disenchantment, dispassion. They do not bring calm and unbinding. They do not bring direct knowledge, and they do not bring awakening. This is why I do not answer these questions. I do make it very clear that dukkha occurs, craving originates, and clinging continues dukkha. Cessation of this process is possible, and the Eightfold Path develops cessation. I make this very clear for one purpose. This develops disenchantment, dispassion, with calming, with unbinding, with direct knowledge, with awakening. This is why I teach the Dhamma. Always remember what I teach, and always remember what I do not teach. Having heard these words, Malankyaputta was satisfied and went on his way. It's the end of the sutta. Much like the Buddha's encounters with Vajragoda and others, the Buddha knew that answering any questions that would only lead to more ignorance and confusion was cruel. Rather than be distracted by his own need to mollify his students or prove how knowledgeable he might be, he remained silent when asked questions that are rooted in ignorance and only seek to further ignorant self-referential views. Through great compassion rooted in profound wisdom and clear vision, the Buddha consistently spared his disciples any teaching that did not directly develop his stated purpose of understanding suffering and the path developing the cessation of suffering. That's the end of the article. So what do you think? Any questions on the article? And we'll go around the room after any questions arise. Well, you all good?
Are you familiar with string theory?
Actually, a little bit, but...
this made me think of, that he was actually on the verge of asking about the concepts of string theory, where things can exist parallel and be present in one and not in the other, or present in both.
And independent of each other,
and
too.
Independent of each other, too.
That's an interesting theory, and isn't it interesting that 2,600 years ago they were asking a very similar question? The string theory taken as to conclusion may eventually prove something, a multidimensional universe. And even if it does, think about that. What does it mean in relation to the Dhamma? Not much.
Right. I mean, if thinking like that brings stress into your life, it doesn't add a benefit, because it isn't anything that is vital, I suppose, as far as we know it now, to maintain a peaceful state of mind. But, there's just interesting, as you describe it, that's exactly what I thought of.
Yeah. And again, that's the Buddha. He didn't say don't consider those questions. Mm-hmm. He did say that they can prove it to be a distraction. Mm-hmm. So for I'm not sure what the right, there's probably a lot of different livelihoods, a theoretical physicist, that's an entirely appropriate thing to get caught up in, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us that haven't taken any further than maybe reading a book about it, like I did, and it was very stressful. getting caught up in the thought proves to be a distraction. If I need to have the answer to are there such a thing as parallel universes, before I get on my cushion, I've got stuck by the arrow and I'm not pulling it out until I get the answer, am I?
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the Buddha's saying. Those are reasonable questions in general, but for someone trying to develop a Dhamma and develop calm and unbinding, they are a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for bringing it up. It's a really great example of what we're talking about. I never thought about it that way, too, that those questions have been around for And they're just now getting to some type of explanation to those questions.
There's a PBS special with a documentary who does a very good sort of pedestrian explanation of it all. Makes it very understandable as he's describing it.
I got to look it up. It is. It's an interesting thing, but not as a distraction.
Did that guy ever join? Did he left the saga? The guy asked all the questions.
You know, when I was writing this, I did a quick search on Malankiputta, and this is the only thing I could come up with. Mm-hmm. But I would bet, do you know, because you've done a pretty good look at
the end of the sutta says he stayed.
Yeah, I would bet. I mean, he was well established in the Sangha. He was considered somewhat of a more advanced monk, so I doubt he left over it. I think
he got the awakening.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say at best, I mean, I would say that the Buddha kept his focus on the Dhamma and reminded him that those other questions aren't important. And you think about, this is the only human life that we know we have. And forget about the theory that we live on and on. So what's most important is not if I can figure out parallel universes and how that works. What's most important, what's most immediate, is to develop a mind that's free of clinging. And then I might decide that I want to pursue that further, but do it from a space of deeply, deeply refined mindfulness, which might be able to hold all those things in. Bonnie, you had a question?
I'm just thinking, it wasn't a question, it's more of a thought, I asked some of those questions when I first came. I think it's like, either he just became quiet, did it, or he lived into them, you know, and I have to make my own mind up about how I either let things go or integrate ideas before I can not cling to them, I guess.
Yeah.
Be able to change my view,
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, I think the Buddha's pointing out that worrying about finiteness or infinity, it's what people think about. It's not part of the Dhamma. And so remember, Malankiputta was saying, I need some answers to these before I'll continue with your Dhamma. And the Buddha's response was, well, it's not part of the Dhamma, so that's why I'm not going to answer it. He didn't say don't ever think about these things.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, we're not talking about the things we need to live, like shoes and food. Those things aren't part of the Dhamma, but I try to apply the thinking to how you're going to look at the things that are there. I mean, whether there's a soul or not, I thought about it in lots of different ways, you know, for me, talk about parallel universe, then how do I have it exist in a way that without making my hair go on fire, you know? But to be able to think about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. Right, I mean, there's still going to be these other things. Well, never mind it.
No, I get your point. Without incorporating them as part of the Dhamma, you made another good point. I need shoes, but just because I need shoes or I need food, Helen was laughing at when you said you needed shoes.
The order of things she put them in: shoes and then food.
Well, you got to have shoes to walk to the store and get the food. Because those aren't part of the Dhamma, thinking about your new shoes, doesn't mean that it's not important when you need new shoes. It just means don't incorporate it as part of your Dhamma. Don't start worshiping your shoes.
I don't have to understand the universe of the shoes in order to know whether
Dhamma is true. Yep. Frank, you had a question?
Oh, I was going to make a statement. I don't get it. I get it, but I don't get it. Like, what's the purpose of teaching something that's irrelative to the end of suffering? It's like the Buddha taught the suffering and stopping suffering.
Yep.
So he doesn't say that it's for everybody. So if you don't get it, if you're practicing meditation and the Eightfold Path, and you have all these questions, and you don't get it, then you don't have to get it.
That's right.
You can become attached to your thinking, and it's like, let it go.
Yeah, yeah, and that's another good point.
You get it.
You do get it.
I get it, the whole attached to the thinking part of it. You can think yourself, you know, right into a corner, and it's like, the whole point of it is to practice meditation, deepen concentration, practice the Eightfold Path, let go of attachments, detach from all that stuff, and have peace. It's like,
give him a gold star. Yeah, you're absolutely right. What's really interesting, even during the Buddha's time, with the Buddha being your teacher, people still got, and this is somebody who was rather advanced, but he still got caught up in his head about these great questions.
That was kind of my really, this guy is well established, and he still comes up with that question after being there for a decent amount of time. He probably came to the Buddha with those questions and kind of set them aside for a while.
Yeah, I would bet.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
Now it's time. And it's quite a commentary on conditioned thinking and how strong it is.
Mm-hmm. You know? Return is miserable life, right?
Pardon me?
You can have your misery return.
Oh, yeah. You know? Well, so the Eightfold Path is just that. It's a path. And you can get off at any time. You can also get back on. You know, Drew?
I always interpreted those questions as the limit of logic and by association language. And the teacher is saying, that's the limit. You're at your limit. You don't go any further with thinking.
Yeah.
And it's like asking somebody, how can I make a baby by talking about it?
Yeah.
At some point, you gotta get on with the business.
That's a really good point, you know. And not having the language for it, in that case, knowledge and language come together. Mm-hmm. Once you understand something, then you will have the words. But of course, you can't explain something that you have no true understanding of, or even in this case, don't want to explain it. You know,
probably even further, that the experience the is not the realm of logic and language. The experience of enlightenment, whatever that may be, is not the realm of language and logic. Mm-hmm. All we can do is, with language and logic, is point to it, and to focus on the question is to look at the finger.
Yeah, that's that great finger pointing at the moon.
Great, that's what I was talking about. You can't explain it, you have to practice it, and then if you're practicing it, you're not really thinking about those things.
Yeah, and you have to experience it. The Buddha did say what awakening is and what it feels like. Awakening is having a calm mind.
You know? My daughter asked me tonight, she was supposed to come here with me. She's having a problem with anxiety, and she showed up at the house rather than meet me in Stockton, and said, you could just tell me how to meditate. I said, you have to practice meditation. I can't tell you how to do it. I can show you how to do it. Let's do it right now. She's like, well, just like write it down and tell me how to do it. That's like me trying to tell you how to swim.
Yeah, you can't. And again, even the Buddha's even the Buddha's description of a calm mind, a mind that's resting in equanimity, we know what the word means. But we really don't know what that experience is until you develop it. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can use language to describe something, but it really doesn't describe an awakened human being. Mm-hmm. Being unbound. How do we know until we do it? Bonnie, you had...
I'm just trying to be logical here and about illogical things. But so I was asking these questions, I guess because it's questions that I wrestle with, but it's about the soul, but... How old is Christianity? How old?
It goes back to Christ.
But this is before Christ.
About 500 years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So where did the concept of soul come from?
Oh, that was around long before the Buddha. It's throughout the Vedas and the Upanishads. the idea of us of a, in fact the another way that the when the Buddha was saying anatta, atta, A-T-T-A, was used to describe an ongoing soul, but also an ongoing soul that is connected to a greater, it's even hard to language, an ongoing soul that's connected or part of a greater cosmos. So again, when the and so there was a connection between that, between the old Vedas and modern Hinduism, that this soul is part of a ongoing cosmos, and that soul is subject to misunderstandings of karma and rebirth and reincarnation, all those things that flowed from that. But it's all part of, in fact, I would say that a soul is necessary to have all the rest of those teachings develop. And so when the Buddha awakened and he studied all those things, he realized that that was not something that led to the goal. He never said it wasn't true.
Whether it was true or not, suffering or not suffering.
Yes, but when he taught anatta, not a soul, that's really what that means, because the soul was used as a way of creating an identity for a self that would last forever. And the Buddha said, because of impermanence, nothing lasts forever, especially you. You are anatta. What you view of yourself is not a self. And that refutes all of those ideas. Again, the Buddha's not saying there's no such thing as a soul. He's saying it's not helpful. So the right questions to ask are, what is dukkha? What originates dukkha? Is cessation of dukkha possible? What's the path? Those are the four noble questions, rather than, do I live forever? And really, I paraphrase this slightly, where Malankyaputta is asking the Buddha, does an awakened person live on? What he's saying really is, does a Tathagata, meaning this awakened person, live on after death, or does the Tathagata not live on? Or does the Tathagata both not live on and live on? Because those are rooted in that idea of an everlasting soul that would then have the qualities of an individual being that could both exist and not exist at the same time. Very confusing and not leading to the goal.
But it's irrelevant if it's just about looking at
the
Four Noble Truths.
Looking at the path. Okay, so this is just another sutta where the Buddha's saying, keep your focus here if you want to awaken.
Then you'll know what shoes to choose.
Yeah, then you'll know. Yeah, I never know.
I
got one pair of shoes. Actually, I have two pairs of black sneakers, so I don't got to worry about it. Right.
I was just going to say that I was raised Catholic with that whole mind frame of like the soul and waiting, spending your whole life in misery to have eternal life and all that stuff.
Yeah, that wasn't for me.
Suffer now so that you can have happiness when you're dead.
Yep,
pay your dues.
Yeah, and so when I'm practicing this path and trying to work into the Dhamma and understanding, if I let myself wander over to here, like with the soul thing and like people dying in my family, mother-in-law, it helps me accept death and let go when I just practice the Eightfold Path and that whole acceptance part of it. When I start getting, it's like just confusing and continued suffering if I go over to the right side with the whole mind frame.
Yeah, and it works to kind of keep you hooked in if you're doing that too. I know, I didn't know why I was so upset with things when I was a young boy, except I was told that just because you're born, you're screwed, and you got this thing called original sin. I got something I didn't even do, but yet I got to pay for it. I never liked that idea. And the whole notion of that there's some nobility in suffering. And there's an example. Every time I went into church, I saw poor Jesus up on that cross. That was a good thing for him somehow. He suffered and died for us. And maybe it's all true. I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm saying that for me, it caused a lot of agitation and distraction because it just didn't make sense. And even some modern teachers talk about modern Buddhist teachers talk about embracing your suffering. I think what they mean to say, it's probably a poor choice of words, is you need to understand suffering. But that's a big difference between embracing your suffering and understanding the cause and the cessation of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there's no value in embracing our suffering, but there is a great value in being present with it and understanding our contribution to it. It's really the heart of the teaching. And this, it's also interesting how this conversation keeps coming back to the heart of the matter. What we're talking about is the heart of the matter. That's an important thing to recognize. When I know that people are getting it in general from the questions they ask and the comments they make, and you're all asking pretty good questions, except Kevin. But
it's just how much we keep putting ourselves in the harm's way, or like knowing that if I do this, it will cause suffering.
Yeah.
If I do this, it's going to make me feel bad. It's like trying to get a bone away from a dog, you know, kind of like, you know, and you, it's okay to let go, but it's sort of practicing that place of, you know, I don't have to suffer, or I don't have to be miserable because my generations before have been miserable.
Yep. There's worldly causes and conditions that create disappointment and unsatisfactory experience throughout all our lives that there's nothing we can do about. But what we can do about or affect is our own contributions to that by reacting to what's occurring rather than simply being mindfully present. This is life. Kevin, how is your meditation going, and do you have any questions?
No, it's going really well. I've traveled a little bit and, you know, still maintain the practice. Just mornings only, but it's consistent, very consistent. I mean, you know, I think this sutta is really relevant. I kept thinking about right view and profound right view, and I mean, you know, this guy was an advanced, you know, sangha member, but sort of was, you know, the profound right view was sort of what he was missing. You know, I think that it's important. You know, those are questions that they're common to the human experience. We're going to have those. There's you want to know those things, right? But going back to the point, I mean, how do we describe something that we don't know and we don't have language for? So why don't we describe what awakening is or feel what that's like and put dot, dot, dot. You know, maybe those questions will become relevant if you're awakened someday. Maybe they won't. I don't know. But I feel like the Buddha's saying, look, like, focus on what I'm teaching you in this and maybe you'll understand those questions from right, profound right view someday, if they matter or they don't. And maybe you have to run, maybe you won't. And you can waste your life thinking about it, or you can do this.
That's right.
So it always just comes back, I think you're right, to right view and profound right view and the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, it's changing the way we're seeing things. And I would bet that Malankyaputta, this was kind of the nudge that he needed, or the clear direction that he needed.
I'm rooting
for him. I think he got it. I'm going to try to find out.
He got it.
I'm going to do a Google search on Malankyaputta.
Get back on track.
Nessa, how was your meditation?
It's all right.
You were able to maintain the method? You recognized when you're caught up in your thoughts and came back to your breath? Oh, that's meditation. So I hope you continue to join us here. Ram, how was your meditation? How's your practice going?
Practice been good, consistent, ups and downs, right? Some days it's, you know, nothing but storm in a teacup out there, and other days it's nice and quiet.
It's just life, huh?
Still working on the meditation hut. I keep distracting myself by building larger and larger structures in my head.
Three bedroom, two story, two bath
right.
Meditation hut. That'll be nice.
Yeah.
Glad you're here. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. My meditation is going well. I do want to kind of cheer on these folks before us and to follow us who think about other things beyond what we have words for. I do recognize that that's not part of, first you have to develop your concentration and then maybe your mind is more ready to come up, you know, to put the answers together. But, you know, there's Kafka and Nietzsche and Green and Einstein and all those people who thought about things that we can't see and came up with the language for it. So, you know, I just want to give a shout out to them too.
I think they deserve it. It's a great point. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Keith, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you, John. My practice is going very well. A couple of weeks ago, I came to your workshop and I voiced some concerns I was having with the whole annihilation of self, ego, that whole battle. And you said you're in the stream, just stay in the stream until you come out the other side. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me until about and I really thought about it, and that was very profound and helped me quite a bit. And it just encouraged me to get deeper and deeper into it. And
take care, Nessa.
Thank you.
It's, yes, it's, I'm going through your book. I just finished week 10. It's wonderful. I wanted to get done before you start back over with it in class so that I've gotten through it once and then can experience the whole thing. Yeah, I think it's really providing a lot of contentment and ease in my life, this whole thing. So I'm very thankful for this and you and everyone here.
Thank you. I'm glad you're a part of it. The that idea of a stream enterer, that's another one of those misapplied teachings. A stream enterer is simply a person who has, well, let me back up a little bit. The ongoing ignorance that we all experience is called samsara, and samsara means this wrong view existence that we're all living in, prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. And so we're wandering around in samsara. It's often presented by the Buddha that we cross the river of samsara to get to the other side. So a stream enterer is one who has entered that stream of crossing to the other side. And as long as you maintain the path, stay in the stream, you know, the stream will itself, the path will carry you across. So that's what that means. So I'm glad you're in the stream. Mary, good to see you tonight. How are you?
That was really profound. That was very helpful. The stream, that's really good. My practice is going better than it has been. I've really dedicated myself to it. I also, and maybe others have already done this, but I also just downloaded your book to my iPad and my phone. And it's what's really nice is at the end of every chapter is, you know, the appropriate sangha discussion, you know. And it's really nice. So I've been spending a lot of time with that. Even though I've been away, I've been benefiting from the sangha for sure.
Yeah.
So, I guess that's all I'll say.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, you too.
Bonnie, how are you tonight?
I'm good. I'm good. So some weeks are good and some not. But so some of the things that I've been working really hard on have sort of, I benefited from it. But then there's this thing that happens to me when things go good. I'm like waiting for it. Well, there's the shoe reference.
Yes.
that something bad will happen, or that, not something bad will happen, but you know, I do something that has a response, a reaction to something that causes me stress. I think just trying to have it that my view of where I am in relationship to it, I can be closer to it in order to then work down the framework so that I can be responsible and responsive to it in a shorter period of time, so to speak, so that, you know, I can catch myself getting caught up in something and like,
yeah.
You've been here, you know that you just walk away, let it go. And, So it's kind of like still kind of testing and trusting the peacefulness.
Yeah, that's right.
Instead of looking towards what we're talking about, the suffering, that I don't have to. It's okay. It's okay. And I could be punished if I let it go. You know, that, well, look, I could, Frank was saying, grew up Catholic, I grew up Jewish, so, you know, there's a lot of suffering there.
And you're also describing becoming unfamiliar with a different point of view. But your becoming is rooted in concentration and refined mindfulness, so it keeps you in the stream. So good
for you. Well, I was gonna say, yeah, it keeps me in the stream.
Yeah. Thank you. Larry, how are you tonight? It's good to see you.
I'm doing good. My practices haven't been going that well. Partially because I think I'm the guy with the arrow in me. Like, I just ask the question. You know, like, I mean, that's why I'm here. I need to change my ways.
Yeah.
You know? Do things differently.
Yeah.
And I think I need to work on that a little bit better. And I mean, like, when I'm here, it goes great. But at home, there's just distractions everywhere. So I think I need to find a better place where I can just get away from temptations and distractions and start there.
Yeah. Right. Well, everybody has said those same words, you know, pretty close. Do the best you can. Be very gentle with yourself. Start with short periods of meditation. I know I said this last week, but 2 or 3 or 4 minutes to get started is plenty. You don't have to sit for 20 minutes or a half an hour. And as far as the place, the location, do the best you can. If you can find a corner of a room that you set up just for your meditation, do that. You know, and that's enough. But your determination is there, so you'll get there and continue to join us. So, glad you're here tonight. Frank, how are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to see you.
You know, I came here, I sought this out because I was suffering, you know, and I suffered my whole life, and I was willing to give up the suffering for a chance at a better way of living, for happiness and peace of mind and joy. So I don't have any questions, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't need to reinvent the wheel. The Buddha already invented it.
Yeah.
He set the wheel in motion. He said, follow directions. And I said, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm here. So I don't really need to question a thing. I just practice. And I have peace of mind today because of it.
Yeah, you do. Thank you for saying that. You bring up another good point. You had a very strong intention initially. Even you didn't even know what this was about at first. But that intention goes a long way to it. Your intention developed into right intention pretty quickly, part of the Eightfold Path. So.
I had to be willing to see things differently.
Yeah.
And that was the willingness. So
yep.
The willingness is really what is the most important thing for me, to be able to see things differently and be okay with it.
Yeah, and what I see that holds people back the most is an unwillingness to change their view, to see things differently. And, you know, again, conditioned thinking, that's all that is. But it's the all, you know. It's the reason why the Buddha gave us an Eightfold Path, because he understood that common human problem of conditioned thinking. I want to see things my way and no other way. Glad you're here. Drew, good to see you tonight.
See you. My meditation's been improving since I've been coming here.
Really?
I'm mindful to meditate. I once heard meditation described as sitting in the forest by a clear pool, and every once in a while, a rare creature comes to drink from the pool and moves on. And I've had some experiences where I really, you know, I don't think words are able to really justify the experience as part of meditation. They've been relatively rare, but I know they exist, and that I can move in that direction and be better. I struggle with two things. One, very practical, I start falling asleep.
Mm-hmm.
I'm exhausted. I have chronic insomnia. And I recall a picture of a monastery years ago that I saw with the monks sitting, and behind them was the master with what was apparently called the stick of compassion.
Kayusaka. I've had the pleasure a few times.
But the other thing that is tough is that I've taken practical steps as a result of my awareness, and I use really vulgar and obscene language regularly. Just
conditioned.
Yeah, it's like you know, one of those comedians from back in the day, every other word. And with awareness, I've stopped, but I don't like it. And when I lapse back into the vulgarities, it feels so much more comfortable. It's like I'm holding my breath for a
Ah, Drew, what the?
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Thank you for your honesty. Talk about a conditioned response to life. You get comfortable in it, and it just got to come out. Thank you. What a great class. Great questions, great comments.
I just say swear jar whenever any of my guys use that language.
That's good. Boy.
Just start docking your wages.
Has it worked?
I haven't done that. I don't think I legally can.
Oh, well. Okay. Great class. A few announcements. December 4th is going to be the next one-day retreat. That's a Sunday from 10 to 3. There's info on the website. I hope you can join us.
Is that a Saturday?
Sunday.
Sunday.
Our friend Bonnie, a few other folks. The Donna dinner is November 22nd, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. So I hope you can all join us for that. Info on the website. We would like to have a few volunteers to help set up and clean up. Setting up would mean getting there around 5:30 or so. And I'm going to put a donation. I think this year's Donna donation project is going to be to raise, I don't think it is. We're going to give money to Julie, the owner of Love and Oven. She's done 7 of these now, and she's never asked for a penny, and she hasn't yet. So I think it would be nice if we could give her a little pile of cash. You know, she does. Well, she does. I think that's it. Oh, I have an online streaming Dhamma class every Wednesday at noon. Dhammastream.com has the info if you want to join us. So that's.
How is the attendance there?
I think it's excellent. There was 3 people last week. I think there'll be 5 this week. So I'm really pleased with it. In fact, I mean the platform I'm using can handle up to 30,000 people. They say I don't expect to get, but
probably
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how to manage. I mean. 5 is enough, but we'll see what happens. It's a lot of fun. What it's allowed me to do is to bring, I think most of them that have been there, this will be the 5th week, are students that haven't been able to get here. They're all over the country. In fact, one guy was on from Italy. And that's really nice to be able to actually sit down and...
I watch it the next morning on the way to work.
Come and join us if you can.
Take a rap on the dashboard.
Wait a minute. Wait, no.
You gotta do the 20-minute Shmatapasa meditation.
you got a car from Elon Musk then, huh? A self-driving car?
Yeah.
You're at the stoplight then, too.
Yeah. I wouldn't advise you to watch the video while you're driving.
I need a distraction.
Okay, that's enough. Let's we'll finish with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a few moments to become mindful of the sensation of breathing and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that have arisen from our talk today. And I think I'll conclude with the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.